Hey there, Star Wars fans, and welcome to the Organa Digest, your weekly Star Wars briefing on what's new and what's neat. This is episode 3, recording on February 26, 2018. And I'm your host, Laura Duncan. This week is not a huge news week, but I am happy to tell you I have the very first segment of Around the Universe. So our guest Xander Tapling is coming up in just 15 minutes. As we roll into March, the novelization of The Last Jedi and the DVD release of The Last Jedi will keep us busy, so this last week of February seems like the calm before the storm. Before I get going into this week's news, I'd like to talk a little bit about spoilers. The Organa Digest, as I've said before, aims to be a spoiler-free podcast, but when we're talking about upcoming projects, there will necessarily be some vaguely spoilery talk. So I will try to stick to this guiding principle. Spoilers equals plot. So for example, if there's news about a new character's name, a costume detail, or we're going to see, you know, X world in this project, to me that's fair game. But in The Last Jedi, Kylo Ren kills Snoke is a plot detail, and a major one at that. So I will keep those off the show. Does this work for everyone? Please let me know. You can hit us up on social media at The Organa Digest on Twitter or email us at organadigest@gmail.com. Now that that's out of the way, I have two bits of news on Solo, A Star Wars Story. Among the many interesting things glimpsed in the trailer for Solo, A Star Wars Story, there is a shot of Lando in the cockpit of the Falcon with a droid. That droid has been identified as L337 and as a girl droid. I know gender may seem like a difficult concept or a silly concept when it comes to droids, but when you think about the Star Wars universe as being largely populated by men anyway, do the droids all have to be men too? BB-8 was rumored to have been originally coded as a female droid, but eventually someone higher up at Disney decided against it. So I'm very happy to meet L337 as the first female coded droid. I don't know who's doing her voice or how we'll be able to tell that she's a female droid, but as we learned from K2SO in Rogue One, as well as from R2-D2 and C-3PO, droids vary drastically from droid to droid in terms of personality. So I can't wait to meet L337 and hear what she has to say. On the subject of Lando, there was a recent profile in The New Yorker of Donald Glover, which is absolutely bonkers. I can't decide if Donald Glover is a genius, insane, maybe both, maybe neither. Did any of you catch the profile of Donald Glover? I'd be interested to hear what you think. He doesn't really talk very much about Solo in the profile, but if you're a fan of Community or his current project Atlanta, there's a lot of information there. So let me know if you read this story about Donald Glover and if you found it as profoundly what as I did. Next item of news about Solo, A Star Wars Story is about the title itself. In China, the film will be released without the words Star Wars in the title. The film is being slated as simply Ranger Solo. Now, as a good old Texas girl, I am personally in favor of anything that makes it sound like Walker, Texas Ranger. However, I'm a little confused about this move. If it's a Star Wars movie, why aren't we calling it Star Wars? Part of this may have to do with the fact that Star Wars has not been doing well in China. Each successive new release from The Force Awakens to Rogue One to The Last Jedi has done worse than the last. So Disney may be trying to sneak this movie in without letting people know it's a Star Wars movie, so someone might accidentally see and enjoy a Star Wars movie without knowing that it's Star Wars. How much do we think that Disney should be worried about this? Is the concern about revenue stream from China going to affect the plot of Episode 9? Would a non-Disney Star Wars, like if Star Wars had stayed as Lucasfilm and not been bought by Disney, would in Episode 9 coming from there be as focused on the international revenue? I don't really have any idea if other countries take the United States into account as they produce their art in the way that the United States takes other countries into account. Do they? Should they? Are we morphing into some sort of universal standard where cinema is concerned? If anyone has more information about this, or even some more coherent thoughts about this, I would love to hear. You can hit us up at The Organa Digest on Twitter or email us at organadigest@gmail.com. Here's a juicy tidbit of news. The Last Jedi novelization's first page has been leaked by a verified Reddit user, and the information on the first page is that Luke Skywalker has a wife. What? Luke Skywalker has a wife? How did we miss this in The Last Jedi? Apparently her name is Kami, which is coincidentally, or not coincidentally, the name of a friend from his Tatooine days. Well, calm down everyone. It turns out that this mention of the wife is a what might have been vision. Luke is sitting there reminiscing on what his life could have been like if he didn't end up joining up with the rebellion. I think that the fact that this is the opening of The Last Jedi novelization, which has been getting a lot of buzz lately for receiving direct input from Rian Johnson. A lot of times these novelizations, these movie tie-ins of books, are just written by somebody quickly turned around to make a buck, and the creator of the film has little to no input. But Rian Johnson sat down with author Jason Fry, and they came up with a couple of scenes that were going to be in the novelization that didn't have time or didn't seem to fit in the film. So I think it's interesting that Rian Johnson gave the green light to start this book off with a vision of what Luke's life could have been like. I think it's a very interesting counterpoint to Rey's vision of what might be. I've been thinking a lot about the fact that both Rey and Kylo Ren have a vision, and each of them concludes from the vision that the other will turn. It seems to me that it's impossible that both of those visions could be accurate, although maybe if the Jedi and the Sith merge into something new or something we haven't seen before, they could both turn away from what they're following right now. I don't know. But upon obsessively rewatching the scene, Rey says she has a vision of what things might be and that Ben will turn. And then Ben says, because of what I saw, I know you'll turn. I saw your parents. So I think it's possible that Ben's vision of Rey's parents induced him to believe that once Rey found out that she was nothing or admitted that she was nothing, that she would turn, but his vision was not of the future, or it was not a vision of Rey as Kylo's empress dressed in black and being a Sith by his side. So I don't know, but I think just this idea of these visions of the future, visions of the past, to have the novelization start out with Luke having a vision of what his life could have been was really interesting. I am personally really pumped to read the novelization. I've already pre-ordered it on Amazon. I'm relieved at the very least to know that it's not some secret dead wife that Luke had that we didn't know, that we now have canon Luke has this dead wife. Please, Disney, if you're listening, can you give us Mara Jade? You gave us Grand Admiral Thrawn. You're bringing in other characters from the extended universe. What about Mara? She's so awesome. We'll do anything. But I digress. In Hollywood news, Mark Hamill, everyone's favorite crazy uncle, is getting his very own star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The ceremony will be held March 8th in Los Angeles, and George Lucas and Harrison Ford will be there. Isn't that nice? It's really sweet. I'm happy that George and Harrison will be there, particularly knowing who won't be there, Carrie Fisher. Mark Hamill has spoken often and eloquently about how close he was to Carrie, what good friends they were, and has said over and over, "I wish you were here. She should be here. She would make this so much more fun." So I'm glad that even though Carrie Fisher won't be at his Hollywood star unveiling, that George and Harrison will be there for him. I didn't realize that Mark Hamill has this pretty vast body of work beyond Star Wars. He did Broadway, he did a lot of TV, he did a stint on General Hospital, and he's done a ton of voiceovers. He did a lot of cartoon voices. He's really quite talented and has had a long and versatile career. If you're interested in watching the ceremony, you can go to www.walkoffame.com. I just love Mark Hamill. I think it's really interesting that, for better or for worse, he's sort of become Luke Skywalker, and that's pretty nice. You know, a lot of actors really try to distance themselves from their characters. They want to make sure that you know that they are a person and their character is a character, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. But Mark Hamill has taken on this mantle, you know. He pretty much is Luke Skywalker. And between him and Carrie Fisher, who, you know, was famously sort of blurred into Leia, you know, you didn't know where Leia began and Carrie Fisher ended, there's a sense that these two characters are these people. And so these people are here for us in real life as well as on the silver screen. And I don't know, I find that pretty comforting. I like the idea that grumpy old man Luke Skywalker is actually alive on this earth as well as in a galaxy far, far away. Incidentally, Mark Hamill is a riot to follow on Twitter if you're a Twitter person. He has a lot of funny tweets. His daughter tweets pictures of him in the olden days, and they joke around a lot. If you're not following him, I would suggest that he's a really interesting follow. So good for you, Mark Hamill. Couldn't be happier for you. And our final bit of news this week comes from the toy world. If you have been through an aisle of Target lately, you may have noticed that besides the regular Star Wars action figures you're used to, there are now these bigger ones, these black boxes. So the Star Wars Black Series is a new line of action figure. They're 6 inches tall, which is, you know, almost twice as big as the regular action figure. And they're really nice. A lot of attention has been paid to detail. They're sculpted a little more carefully than a regular action figure. They're really, it's a bang for your buck for these figures. Well, they are getting even better than they are. There was a news story this week about a new painting technique that makes the faces way more realistic and cool. A lot of times with these figures being painted, you know, there's a splotch of paint that's not where it's supposed to be. I mean, these things are run through machines. It's done quickly. There's not a great attention to detail. But this new technique makes them a lot more individually painted and a lot more perfect, a lot more lifelike. They said specifically the Rey action figure has been plaguing these designers ever since Rey's introduction into the Star Wars universe. And now with this new painting technique that they're able to use, they feel that they're finally able to do Rey justice, which I think is really great. Women in particular will benefit from this. I have some really masculine looking Princess Leias from my 90s Kenner action figures. Action figures are all G.I. Joe based, and they really are not doing a great job of making female action figures, but they're getting better and better. So any advances in action figure technology, I support. I would love to see a documentary on how action figures get made, actually. I have so many of them, way more than I think I want anyone to know, and way more than my husband wants anyone to know. So I would love to know a little bit more about how they are constructed, who designs them, where do they come from. I love them, and I would love to know more about them. Well, that's it for the news this week. And coming up next is my dear friend, Xander Tapling, Star Wars enthusiast, who is going to explain the Knights of the Old Republic video game and what it means for the Star Wars universe as a whole in our very first segment of Around the Universe. So stay tuned. So, Xander, what is it that you would like the listeners of the Organa Digest to know about today?
Well, Laura, part of what I grew up on in the Star Wars franchise was video games. In particular, I think one that has done a great service to Star Wars lore is the two-game series, Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic.
Okay. So, how does one play Knights of the Old Republic? What sort of equipment does one need?
So, when Knights of the Old Republic came out, it was only available for Microsoft Xbox, which, for those of you who currently play consoles at home, it's two generations in front of the Xbox One. It was subsequently released for PC, and I think is actually still available on PC through a platform called Steam.
I'm pretty sure I heard someone talking at a Books a Million about playing it on PC the other day. I was eavesdropping in the Star Wars section, so. Yes, randos at Books a Million can confirm. So what sort of video game is this? Are you flying around? Are you walking around? I know next to nothing about video games. So how do you partake in the Star Wars universe in the Knights of the Old Republic?
Sure. So there is a little bit of flying around, but it's largely done through walking around. I would actually say that most of the game is played by talking to people. There is obviously a heavy emphasis on combat because Knights of the Old Republic, Jedi Knights, it's Star Wars. You can't really get away from the wars in Star Wars.
It's not Star Peace, Xander. It's just not.
And frankly, that just wouldn't sell as many copies.
That's true. So you're walking around. So was this a, quote, first-person shooter game?
No, so this is what's known as a role-playing game, where essentially a player jumps into the game and assumes the role of a character. In this particular game, you assume the role of a character who starts the game nameless, and that is all I'll say about the character for now.
And so this person goes out and interacts with other characters. So are there people we know in the Star Wars universe? Are there familiar faces in Knights of the Old Republic?
So Knights of the Republic, as it stands alone, doesn't have all that many familiar faces for people who are just joining the series now. However, the reason that I thought it relevant to this particular podcast is that there is a link to Star Wars Rebels, the TV show that Disney has been putting out now for a couple of years, that essentially went back in time and said, yeah, that Knights of the Old Republic game, some of the events that took place there are canon, which was very exciting for people like me who thought that when Disney took over the franchise and essentially wiped out the lore of the Holocron and Extended Universe, that all of our games had also been flushed down the toilet.
I am intimately familiar with that feeling of betrayal at the wipeout of the Extended Universe. Disney's giving the Legends a nose job, which is they're scrapping what they don't like and fixing up what they do. And so the Solo trailer in particular gave me hope. There's some rumblings that scene with the Star Destroyer might be in the Kessel system, which is something people from the books would recognize. And so it's good to hear that they've already made good on their promise to introduce a few of the characters that we know and love back into canon. So possibly they'll continue to do so.
Absolutely. I mean, another great example, again, from Star Wars Rebels, and re-implemented Grand Admiral Thrawn, who I'd argue, outside of obviously Palpatine and Darth Vader, is probably, I'm going to rank him the third most popular villain in all of the extended universe. And they just looped him right back in immediately. And I think one of the more important things, to get crass about it for a minute, Disney likes to make money. If the fans like a particular part of the extended universe that Disney removed, chances are they'll add it back in if we keep saying we like it.
You know, that's a very good point. And I think Disney is very good at making money. And so it's an interesting time to be a Star Wars fan because with, you know, Twitter and social media, we are so much closer to the creators of this content that we love than we ever have been before. And sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. I saw, you know, J.K. Rowling is coming off less and less great in social media. And, you know, we all...
I retroactively add this thing that everyone wanted.
Or I retroactively don't care that you don't want Johnny Depp in this movie because it's my movie and I don't care about you. So we have this sort of turning on our creator moment. We've done it with Lucas and it seems like it's happening with Rowling right now. You can't have Harry Potter. It's ours. But she made Harry Potter.
Exactly. I think the benefit of Star Wars being revamped in this particular way is when Star Wars came out, there was only one person who really kind of ate, drank, breathed Star Wars, and that was George Lucas. Now, if you look at people like Kathleen Kennedy, who now runs LucasArts and Lucasfilms, the generation that is now essentially running Star Wars is the generation that grew up on Star Wars. They were the people who waited in line in the 80s to go see the movies. They were the people who were there when the Christmas special was on TV. So you're right that we're closer to the creators than ever before, and I think that's partially because the creators are the fans as opposed to the creators as creators.
It's like Barack Obama being the first president who grew up watching Sesame Street, and so his commitment to funding public broadcasting stems from a personal place. Well, that's good to hear. So this Knights of the Old Republic video game, I will probably not play because I don't understand video games. I kind of start and ended with Duck Hunt, but you mentioned that you have a theory about this game and how this game sort of ties into the larger Star Wars universe as a whole and sort of enriches your understanding of the Star Wars universe, particularly what we're talking about going forward. And so can you say a little bit more about how the KOTOR franchise informs your worldview of the Star Wars universe and what you think might happen going forward?
Start with a very general backstory on Knights of the Republic, realizing that it's, you know, over a decade old. God, I've gotten old. But, you know, still not wanting to spoil it for those of you who are going to listen to this podcast and no doubt rush home and try and play it, which I absolutely encourage you to do. The broad backstory of Knights of the Old Republic is essentially, this is in an era of Star Wars history. The time was known very, very, very ominously as the Dark Wars.
Let me stop you right there. Sorry, this is something we should have covered a long time ago. When does this take place in the Star Wars universe?
So I have it written down on a post-it note because this is such a convoluted and precise number that only a Star Wars fan could have come up with it. Approximately 3,956 years before the opening title scroll on A New Hope.
Excellent. So that's another reason we don't really see anybody we know, because they are so far from being born.
Exactly. I mean, this is 4,000 years before Darth Vader, which means it's probably, you know, 3,940 years from Darth Vader being born. But yeah, so we see common tropes, right? We see the roguish, lovable smuggler. We see the Wookiee companion. We see, you know, the astromech with a spunky personality. All of those things infiltrate the game. But essentially, yeah, you're exactly right, first of all, that we will not see anybody we know who is reoccurring in films and movies that are currently coming out. But essentially what's going on in this era in history is the Sith are not just one or two people controlling an empire. The Sith are an empire unto themselves. There are Jedi, there are soldiers, and they are in direct conflict with, at the time, the Galactic Republic. The character that you play essentially has to pick a side in this war and go forth and essentially spread either evil or good throughout the galaxy. The reason, and the theory that I told Laura that got her to bring me onto this podcast after I begged for no less than 25 minutes.
We're very selective here at the Argana Digest, only the best for my listeners.
But essentially, one of the storytelling mechanics that BioWare in the first game and Obsidian in the second game really hammered on is this notion of the non-direct or the non-clear-cut motivation. You know, good people doing bad things for good reasons and bad people doing good things for arguably okay reasons.
That sounds kind of strange to me for video game because I sort of assume, you know, it's running around good guys good, bad guys bad, pow, pow, pow. So this is a lot more nuanced than I would have expected from a video game.
Yeah, and I would argue that, I mean, even Wars has been like that as a franchise, right? I mean, really until, you know, if we're thinking just the original trilogy, until Episode 6, Darth Vader and Emperor Palpatine were the unmistakably evilest people, and there's absolutely no exception. And then Episode 6 rolls around, and, Darth Vader might not be such a baddie. But Palpatine is still, you know, bathrobe evil incarnate. And I think, you know, this was back in 2003, but I think what happened at that point is both fans and writers started to essentially mature a little bit, and they saw the shades of gray that lend themselves to more complicated moral decision-making. And that's what I think we're actually, I mean, I think we've already seen it, particularly in The Last Jedi, but I think we're going to see more of it come Star Wars Episode 9, yet to be titled, but probably not The Last Jedi Part 2.
Okay, so you're saying that this sort of narrative complexity, this step away from the black and white universe of Star Wars, that the first time we really saw it in the Star Wars universe is Knights of the Old Republic. And then that sort of enabled Rogue One to do what it did, which then enabled Last Jedi to do what it did. So if you're into the sort of complicated nature of The Last Jedi, we could possibly thank Knights of the Old Republic for that, for the ability to go there.
As a video game nerd, I will absolutely say that Knights of the Republic is directly responsible for Disney's writing, so I really don't have that much faith in BioWare's influence in Hollywood. But yes, in essence, and I think, you know, we've seen some of that, but you look at Last Jedi, I mean, the storyline that jumps into my mind immediately is the constant warring that Rey goes through in envisioning what happened to Kylo Ren on the night that the Academy burned down. You see Luke Skywalker, who for the first three films, and even, you know, to the small extent he was in The Force Awakens, he was the epitome of good. You know, he was humble, he was lowly, he came from nothing, he became a Jedi Knight. You know, he vanquished evil. And even in The Force Awakens, people are holding him to that standard. So in the first couple sequences, we have a hard time believing that Luke could ever do something so brutal to Kylo, and Kylo must have started it.
Despite the fact he says, this isn't going to go like you think it will, we didn't take him at his word.
Right. I mean, the one mistake everybody makes in all of The Last Jedi is not listening to Luke.
That's like, fair enough.
And the second mistake everybody makes in The Last Jedi is not listening to the female characters on screen, because if they had, the movie would be 10 minutes long. It would be 10 minutes long and half as many people would have died.
It's so true. So do you think, based on this sort of shades of gray theory, I'm going to call what you're talking about, that there is hope for Kylo Ren to be redeemed? This is the million-dollar question, right? What's going to happen with Kylo Ren?
So I'm going to do the typical fan thing and equivocate the crap out of my answer. I think there is a chance at redemption, but I think the more important question we should have as Star Wars fans going forward into Star Wars Episode 9 and into the rumored Obi-Wan film and into Solo, A Star Wars Story, is we have to, as a fan base, re-examine our thresholds, both for atonement and what redemption's purpose actually is. Because at this point, what is atonement and what is redemption for Kylo Ren? Is it coming to the, quote, light side of the Force, which forced Luke to try and kill his own apprentice temporarily? Or is it simply coming back to a sense of balance in the middle, where we might not think Kylo Ren is a good guy at the end of Episode 9, but he's far better than we thought he was at the beginning? And I think that shade of gray that, you know, is rooted really in Knights of the Old Republic is now really heavily influencing the writers of these movies. And I think that's something that is worth considering for the average Star Wars fan.
Well, I certainly look forward to seeing what happens in Episode 9, and I appreciate the roots of this complexity, which I have been really digging as a Star Wars fan, getting away from the black and white. Although I do love me some black and white, good guy, bad guy. The world is a different place than it was back in the 80s and when Force Awakens came out. And I think it's Star Wars is definitely a movie of its time, and as the times change, Star Wars has to change too. So that's interesting. To know the roots of that come from Knights of the Old Republic. Well, thank you so much for being on our show, Xander. We appreciate having you, and thanks for the information from your corner of the universe.
Absolutely.
Well, that's our show this week, friends. I hope you enjoyed. Remember, you can always reach the podcast on social media. Email us at organadigest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @TheOrganaDigest. Let us know what you think and if you'd like to be featured in an upcoming segment of Around the Universe. See you next week, and may the Force be with you.